Yes. Back to you now. Is it the RFC? Yeah. Can you take your positions? You are always two. Two. Okay. We must move. And because, let's take our seats, honorable members. Before we take the next submission, now I was checking, I saw somewhere there's going to be a memorial service of the late, which is tomorrow. Yeah, so I just wanted to say to another member, it will be important that we attend that memorial service. The details I don't have. What time? Yeah, all assembly chamber at 1. Now, but also at the same time, I just wanted to indicate that the committee, or the committee for Standing Committee on Finance and Research, I mean, appropriations, we have been blessed to have Fundisi Wecwele as the researcher for finance. She's sitting here on our left, and then there's the researcher Brandon Els. Where is Brandon? Oh, I thought you were Chief's younger brother. Okay, Brandon. I just wanted to make you feel at home. We are all welcomed. Participate fully in the work of the committee or committees. Thank you very much. Bongani, I know you can be very elaborate on everything that you present. But because of time constraints, your work is a very important one for the committee because it links us with everything that we are supposed to do, including other fields of government. Try to be as short as you can. If you have to say one sentence, say it. Don't say it and paraphrase it. With many other issues. Thank you very much, Wanga.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm not going to take that much time. What I'll do is I'll just give a brief background to the submission. I think that's in terms of the law. Just keep that slide. And then we then must actually just highlight a few things that inform our submission. Then Dr. Ramos Mabugo will quickly take you through the rest of the detail of the submission. I think the issues that are on that slide have actually been spoken to by the two previous presenters. I think what we from the Commission's perspective, the subdued growth rate, our recovery in the global economy will actually does have an impact, and it's reflected in the suboptimal growth in the economy. We also think that the economy is not collapsing, So that is a very good, it's not performing well enough to make a meaningful contribution to the reducing or impacting on the high unemployment rate. But the conditions, I think, we think in this particular budget and foundations have been laid, because the budget is premised on the National Development Plan. So there is a vision, there is a storyline around what each sector of the economy must do. And I think what we need to emphasize is that as we move into the strategic plans and annual performance plans of government, we will be able to link what is into this, in what is built into this budget around the NDP imperatives. At least over the MTEF is actually reflected in those departmental plans. We think that's an important issue that must be taken into account. In terms of the proposed fiscal reforms in the budget, Ramos will give a few details around those. But we think that the fiscal reforms aim to create a fiscal framework which will give South Africa greater ability to increase sustainable economic development, and the key pillars are long-term competitiveness and also the ability to respond to global trends and patterns. I think some of the issues have been talked to around that issue, for example, changing markets, global markets, and where the focus should be directed and who should be playing the key role in those areas. And we also maybe might want to ask the question, what is the likelihood of the fiscal framework and revenue proposals for them to actually meet those key objectives that are espoused also in the National Development Plan. Now, the two key areas that we focus on, which this government undertook to improve, because we don't think that it's a question of just pumping money into the economy, but using the money more effectively and efficiently. So we're looking at whether this budget basically creates those conditions for enhanced efficiency in terms of the framework that it's premised upon, and also the sustainability. There are some policies that were adopted that we have all agreed to, that is fiscal counter-cyclical fiscal policy, and also the fiscal rules that accompanied the decisions around the fiscal policy stance of government. And so the presentation will touch on those kind of details, just to test those, and then we'll make some concluding remarks. Ramos.
Yeah, thank you. So if I can just paraphrase what I'm going to say. Through our interactions since 2010 medium-term budget policy statement with the House, when you look at the inputs that we've received from you, you can break them down into two areas, the efficiency issues and sustainability issues. So what we went back to do was to unpack those and develop criteria that we can use to process each budget cycle around those two criteria. Now, starting with the issue of enough efficiency. Efficiency speaks to getting maximum output from a given amount of resources. So if there is a technology that allows you to get more, then efficiency says you should use that which gives you the highest possible output for your given resources. Now, in terms of this criteria, the Commission supports the main things that are in the 2010 budget on how can plans be used, the levers that are available to it to boost South African economic growth. There are two main reasons for that. The first is that the economy is projected to grow at 2.5%. So what economic growth means is, as the acting chairperson mentioned, it means that the economy is still growing. We may argue over the magnitude of the growth, but it's still growing, which brings us to the conclusion that we're not collapsing. So we are arguing over magnitude of economic growth. And 2.5%, what that has done is to ensure that at the very minimum, we have had three successive years of positive economic growth since the 2009 recession, or since 2010 MTBPS when we started engaging with this commission. Now, 4% that's mentioned in the National Development Plan to make inroads into attaining the level of jobs that are mentioned for 2030 to eliminate poverty by 2030. So although we are growing at 2.5%, we are still halfway to the amount of growth rate per annum where we should be if we want to attain those goals. So in terms of efficiency, now we need, how can we enhance efficiency? So we looked at the expenditure component revisions by functional classification in that table there. And when we look at the change in the 2013 budget compared to 2012 medium-term budget policy statement, the overall message is that there are hardly any major changes to what was promised in the medium-term budget policy statement, but there are nuanced changes. The first that we want to point out is that science and technology has received a highest priority. It's growing by 12.4% compared to where we thought it would go by in the 2012 medium-term budget policy statement. And we think that's important because ultimately to drive the infrastructure strategy, you are going to need scientists and engineers, and the pipeline for development of that kind of skill lies around science and technology, and we think that's a good thing. We notice that transport, energy, and communication are falling compared to where they were supposed to be by minus 3.2%, and that causes some worries, but we understand the reasons behind the downward reduction for those areas. But those are two important levers for pushing us towards the economic growth rate that we set ourselves to attain the two major objectives of poverty reduction and unemployment reduction as in the National Development Plan. So we highlight those two areas for discussion. So the next item or set of issues that we're bringing here are issues around sustainability, and again deriving from the discussions we've been having. What we've done is to unpack sustainability into three key areas that speak to this house. We look at macroeconomic stability, budgetary stability. In terms of macroeconomic stability, here we're looking at the ability to respond swiftly and decisively to short-term economic pressures, which is vital to minimize negative shocks to economic growth, jobs, and investment. When we started this discussion, we were talking about the 2009 global economic crisis, and we all agreed that it's important to be agile for the economy to be flexible to be able to respond to that. So since 2009, we've seen government committing to cushioning poor households by maintaining the social safety net, showing agility in responding to an exogenous crisis. So from the evidence that we've got, we think that government is still committed to countercyclical fiscal policy and fiscal guidelines with plans to reprioritize towards maintaining those social safety nets. So in terms of that stability, agility that I've spoken to, we are fairly satisfied that the continued stance is still coming through in the budget 2013 statement. The second aspect of budgetary stability has to do with stability of the system as a whole. And here we think the equitable share formula, the conditional grants, the setting of 3-year spending plans provides predictability for the decentralized budget, and that has been attained. But what we notice from that framework for budgetary stability is that the contingency reserve has been taking a lot of the stress in terms of maintaining stability, which is a new trajectory, if you want, compared to what had been happening before. We're seeing more and more that wide contingent reserve taking a lot of the adjustment burden for maintaining budget stability. And around the budgetary stability of the system itself. Now, continuing with budgetary stability, the other issue is the commitment by government to consolidation. Starting in 2010, government in the 2010 budget announced consolidation plan that was very aggressive, going back to what is considered to be long-term budget deficit 3 years later. But when we came to the 2011, and that's the black line, and the 2012 budget, the blue line, we see a change in trajectory where government slowed down on its commitment to consolidation, but became more aggressive in the outer years of the expenditure framework, i.e. the last 2 years, becomes aggressive in order to close the budget deficit. When you look at the 2013 budget, we are now beginning to see a different trajectory from the last 2 years. That is now much less aggressive in consolidating. So whether the consolidation around expenditures or the proposed tax reform that I will speak to later will be sufficient to bring us back to the 3.1% budget deficit are issues that we should engage in. But you definitely see the change in trajectory from an aggressive consolidation to a more benign or a less aggressive consolidation stance in the 2013 budget. Now, the second element of sustainability speaks to issues of affordability. In other words, plans must be affordable, not just in this cycle, but going forward. And we can even say going forward to 2030, because the National Development Plan has given us a horizon on which to address affordability. Now, the government programs in the 2013 budget aimed at the objectives of accelerating growth and fighting poverty and unequal opportunities, settle around job creation, education, health. And in terms of the affordability aspects of the programs, we can rely on the preliminary findings from government long-term fiscal report, which suggests that for 15 to 25 years, the programs around education and health don't necessarily impose unsustainable resource pressures on the fiscus. What we've done is to check those findings with our own commission models that run up to 2050, and we find that the programs to address poverty, unequal opportunities and economic growth are sustainable in medium to long term, but with one important condition, that those expenditures must be productive. So if you relax the government expenditure productivity assumption, in other words, if you allow for wastage, then programs can easily become unsustainable, unaffordable going into the future. So our social expenditure, social grants, etc., education, are sustainable with an important provision that expenditure must be highly productive. Now, looking at the macroeconomic outlook and immediate fiscal risk confronting us, I think the biggest strategic risk, at least in the medium-term expenditure framework, are economic deficit. And by economic deficit, here we are thinking in terms of the fiscal deficit, the trade deficit, and the equality and poverty. Those are the three key strategic risks to be dealing with in the immediate to medium-term period. We think with fiscal downturn, that implies that very difficult choices will have to be made, and we think the reprioritization that has been proposed to ensure growth-friendly expansion needs to be maintained. from a sustainability perspective, there are two aspects. The sovereign debt downgrades that we've begun seeing coming more routinely, and the issue of public debt itself in terms of how you service it and its level. I come back to those two key points. In terms of sovereign debt downgrades, three rating agencies have downgraded South Africa. And what sovereign downgrades do is that they increase the borrowing cost and debt service cost for government, therefore impinging on how much your available revenue can buy. In other words, it simply makes it more expensive or more costly to attain your national development plans. The reasons for the downgrade, if one wants to paraphrase them, is really increased levels of indebtedness, socioeconomic and political factors that the rating agencies are raising. Now, in the 2012 response to the fiscal frameworks and revenue proposals, the Commission came here and essentially did not agree with the downgrades. We thought they were not entirely warranted. And we still commit to the position that we're on in the 2012 response to the fiscal frameworks. We think there's need to consider government's commitment to counter-cyclical fiscal policy and fiscal guidelines with the proposed plan to reprioritize while maintaining the social safety net. Of course, there's room for improvement in the composition of expenditure, eradication of wasteful expenditure in the public sector wage bill. But in terms of the general direction that we're going with the 2013 budget, we still stick our necks out to say the rating agencies need to take that counter-cyclicality stance and not rush into downgrades. So looking at the public debt aspect of it now, we see that there is increasing state debt burden, which implies that expenditure is increasingly being financed by the debt. That's what those lines there are showing you. So increasingly we are debt financing our expenditures. But when you look at the loan debt in real terms, we see that it's increasing, but the real state debt has been falling. And the reason why the real state debt has been falling has to do with what we discussed last time when we spoke about the switch program that the government is on. And we then said that the switch program has to do with substituting maturing debt with longer-term instruments so as to cushion the consolidation. It does make sense when you're in a period of a crisis, but there is always an inherent risk that you can buy long-term debt in depressed conditions at higher cost than you would have bought it in other normal conditions. So the risk to look out for there in terms of the switch program will be the rate that we're doing at the switch debt or negotiating at the switch debt. It's what will determine whether it was a good deal for the country in the long term. But we're picking up the switch program and the declining debt costs associated with it. Now coming to revenue proposals, revenues have been revised downward compared to the 2012 budget, and this is due to weaker economic growth and reasons associated with the value added tax revenue growth. And the Commission does welcome the idea of fiscal consolidation through expenditure efficiencies as opposed to rushing into tax increases. So we welcome that because in the short term it supports the suboptimal economic growth that we are witnessing. And we welcome the major tax reform that's being talked about in order to address more forcefully the long-term issues around tax revenues, which in a large chunk are explaining the budget deficits that we are seeing. So in a nutshell, the proposed tax structure, you can split into direct taxes and indirect taxes. On the direct side, tax side, we are happy with the tax relief on individuals of 7 billion and the tax breaks, around business, those if exploited can support economic growth and promote job creation. As we mentioned in our submission for the 2014-15 Division of Revenue, it was one of our recommendations around those interventions. On the indirect taxes, there are some interesting interventions taking place there. The main one is the comprehensive carbon tax proposal for 2015-16, and I think there was very good discussion during the Buza and Fedusa presentation around the carbon tax, where it was raised that, but it can actually destroy jobs. And from the Commission side, we actually support the idea behind the carbon tax. And our support for it is wider, not necessarily as a climate change intervention, but as an environmental sustainability intervention, where the aim is to make sure that the production base for South Africa is sustainable and can continue going forward. So the carbon tax does that, but it does that by changing the behavior of agents, be they consumers, be they business. So what we call for is that if it's a true behavioral change instrument, then there must be mechanisms to reinforce it, so that the concerns about job losses could ideally be financed from the revenues gotten from the sinners, or the ones that are polluting the environment. If it just goes into a general revenue fund, then it will not affect behavior, or you won't be able to address the direct negative consequences that honorable members were raised around that context. So that's important proviso that we think needs to come into it, that the revenues from the tax must be used to ameliorate or address the direct negative consequences of the tax itself. And that way you get what's called double dividend. You safeguard the environment and you prevent job losses that were necessitated by a tax. How can South Africa's fiscal framework be improved? We started the conversation again last year. We think improving long-term fiscal reporting must continue focusing on long-term risk, and government has promised that the full document will be out during the course of the year. But we think there should be extended public debate on the long-term fiscal challenges that are going to come out of the discussion documents, and this House will be central to negotiating or organizing that public debate. But one thing that we didn't mention last time is the distributional impact of new policies, particularly on gender and children, that we think a long-term fiscal report eventually should look into after the initial set of work. And in the document, we mentioned why we think looking at it from a gender dimension, that makes sense for South Africa, because it comes from a purely efficiency reason, that gender lenses allow you to evaluate different social rates of return of government investment as opposed to a gender-blind type analysis. So while the social rate of return from some government programs may be higher, if you don't put on that lens, you will come up with rates of return that are low, and as a result, postpone or cut down on certain programs that may have very high social rates of return. We also think a consolidation of fiscal reporting should take into account a local government contribution to infrastructure development, not just what comes from national, but what local government itself is investing in. That will be very useful. Again, integration of the national development plan into the budget process quite forcefully. Currently, what we have are medium-term expenditure frameworks, which evolve from simple macro fiscal frameworks, and they need to go into comprehensive processes that are actually driven by national development plans. And this is not just about attaching a number to it, but actually starting from the NDP and costing the MTEF from that perspective. Then around tax reform, what we want to add here is that we think the reform should be broadened and not just look at tax revenues, but all revenues in their entirety. And here we have in mind that we also need discussion around what is the optimal level of debt to attain the National Development Plan. We continue coming and have the arguments about debt stabilizing at 37.4% of GDP or 40% of GDP. What is the optimal level of debt for us to eradicate poverty by 2030, to continuously grow by 5.4%? Is it 40%? Is it 33%? Is it 1%? What is that optimal public debt? So we think the government should seize this opportunity to take reform to do a broader reform, including borrowing policy and optimal debt. So in conclusion, I think what we have done...
I think, Chair, the conclusion is just a summary of the key points that we've tried to address in the submission. There's more detail, obviously, in the text form, which is not the PowerPoint, but the text form of the submission that you can, members can look at. And I'm sorry for, let's apologize for submitting it this late. We were busy trying to separate so that we are able to speak to issues that this particular committee deals with, because tomorrow we have to deal with the other two committees. So we're trying to separate those things without losing too much information on both sides. Thank you.
Over the weekend, I was told to don't apologize in the meeting because we take more time by apologizing. Can we take the next submission?
Thank you. My name is Pete Nell. I'm from SAICA, and I have with me David Tickle, one of our the deputy chairman of our National Tax Committee and also a tax partner at one of the big accounting firms in South Africa. We thank you for the opportunity to speak to you here. I'll just talk from here and advance the slides from here. We thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. Our overall expertise lies in tax laws, and we are close involved, as we've explained last year as well, in the process, and we meet regularly with Treasury and make submissions when the law becomes available. The budget generally does not contain all the detail that one would need to make the comments on, but we have tried to do some high-level comments on that. Something that we didn't address in our budgets, in the comments on the budgets, is the review that, and we believe that Justice Davis will head on the tax policy. We recommend it. We've had last the Margo and Katz commissions many years ago, and we really welcome the appointment there of Justice Davis to deal with that. If I could deal with some of our general comments, our first comment deals with the tax ombud. We cover that in page 1 and 2 of our commentary to you. we were really hoping that the minister would appoint the tax ombud this year, and we thought that the budget speech would have been appropriate. So our first comment really deals with things that were not covered in the budget speech. We hear from our members, and we hear from members of the public, generally frustrations that they experience with tax administration and not getting issues resolved. So when you are assessed immediately and your money is refunded, nobody complains, but when you have problems, you seem to be having big problems trying to sort that out. Our second point dealt with the timing of the budget. This was the first time, certainly in my experience, that the budget was delivered before the end of the financial year for individuals, which impacts on tax deductions and tax deduction tables. And in our submission, we deal with that, and the really heavy burden it placed on, for instance, life companies that have to calculate taxes up front of the year when they determine a new annuity payout. And the problem that they experience is if they don't have the time to change their systems and incorporate the new tax tables, which were proposed in the budget, and this year they only have 2 days to do so, they find that they over-deduct tax, which must then be later refunded, which leads to additional administrative burdens in running the process. We then are really thankful for the Minister mentioning a number of our proposals. I will deal with some of them in a bit more detail, but just to highlight that the bursaries one, we've requested that the amounts, and we've heard Professor Raymond Parsons say this morning that education is one of the important things. We see it from our experience that employers actually make use of this benefit, giving assistance to employees to study and to the dependents or relatives. And we certainly welcome the fact that the bursary amounts, the remuneration has been doubled. The bursary amount is split into two component parts, dealing with higher and let's say school education, so we welcome that. With VAT registration, I'll deal on the next one. The VAT and business rescue, we pointed out an anomaly last year in the legislation, or not anomaly, a problem that also stands in the way of business rescue, where a business rescue plan has been started and then is hampered by the VAT legislation. And we really sense the Minister mentioning this in the budget and a intention on their side to also resist this problem. Then we've also dealt with the debt supply between connected persons. There were some anomalies and cash flow problems experienced by people and having to pay them bad money, the VAT up front, and being out of pocket. We will not deal with that in detail, but these mentioned, and we believe that would be addressed in the legislation when we see that. As I said, I'll get back to the value-added tax proposals. We at SAICA certainly hear this from our members and from people that when the issue is raised in public forums, we get requests from the public at large as well. And we heard also Professor Parsons refer to getting small business and the length it takes to start up a new business. Our biggest concern is with tax registration, and there are some issues in the legislation, and we've made lengthy submissions to SARS and Treasury on this regard. In this regard, we discussed it last year. We had a meeting with Treasury and SARS that was scheduled in September, in July last year, and nothing happened. We hear more and more onerous requirements being placed on businesses when they apply, and it really, really, we find it frustrating, and we said add to the length of time to get a person on the tax system to start paying taxes. And the problem, and this is following from the Tax Administration Act now, which was implemented last year on 1 October, is that if you haven't in time registered, there's automatic application of penalties and automatic, and it becomes cumbersome to get these penalties reversed. And it's got cash flow implications where the person cannot get the money out of the system that was put into that system. Our submission on the apportionment issue, where a business makes mixed supplies, non-financial sector ones, we've met the SARS, made lengthy submissions, and the copy of our submission is also attached to that. It's a bit technical, but also we find an unfair treatment by SARS, where people are actually engaged in making mixed supplies and cannot claim all their input taxes. I'm very mindful of the time, so I hope I'm not rushing and missing things. If I do, I hope that my colleague will pick up on that. I certainly find the proposal to change the taxation of us, and I will address some, and maybe if we have in the question time, also have time to just deal with the question of tax avoidance that was raised here. we do not agree, let's just complete that sentence. We find this proposal to amend the taxation of buses one of significance, and it would impact widely. We certainly do not share the view held by SARS that trusts are predominantly set up to avoid tax. We do admit that there are certain structures that were set up and have made use of trusts, but in the main, the view of our members is that trusts are not set up with tax avoidance as their main purpose. I'll quote this from a very recent decision in the Supreme Court of Appeal, where we see that even on our common law side, trust law is still developing. We suggest that to change the trust law and the taxation of trusts should be a highly well-researched project and should not be done overnight. We believe particularly that if tax avoidance, and we said this with earlier submissions, earlier proposals and amendments to legislation, if tax legislation is driven by anti-avoidance, we end up with very complex law. We'll mention that again. But we have a general anti-avoidance rule in legislation, and if SARS uses that and say that this is driven by tax benefit, then really they have all the armory at their hands to deal with that tax avoidance successfully. And we see that when they come to the court, and people that have been driven by tax incentives, tax avoidance, deliberate or aggressive tax avoidance, normally end up in court and generally are dealt with in the courts in accordance with the law. Then one of the other reasons, and the judge mentioned that in the quote that I made from the Supreme Court of Appeal, is that the state duty is being used, or the trust is being used to reduce the state duty. We've heard the minister say 2 years ago, also mentioned that, didn't mention it in this year's budget, that the state duty is under revision, and we hear that it may be abolished. It certainly is a double tax with a capital gain that arises on death, and then you have the additional estate duty on the same, principally the same assets. We've seen law introduced this year, the act was signed this year on debt, where they say if we waive debt, we won't have a double count. We won't have a estate duty and an income tax. And we certainly believe that if trusts are used for avoidance of estate duty, which the judge admits that it is, with the estate duty being abolished, one must be careful in changing trust law, taxation of trusts, just merely to address that. And I'll hand over to Deborah.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'd just like to address a question that was raised earlier regarding tax consultants, because that's what I do for a living. And I do thank the government because they give me a lot of work. And the reason why they give me a lot of work is because I spend my entire days making sure that taxpayers pay the right amount of tax in terms of the law. So our clients come to us, they say they're going to do a transaction or they're going to earn some money, and they say, how am I going to be taxed? And we tell them, if they've done it wrong, we approach SARS and we tell SARS that they've done it wrong, and we organise for them to pay the right amount. So contrary to common belief, tax consultants are not out to do the government in. So just off that note, I thought I should just clarify that matter. I'm going to cover a couple of cross-border issues. The first one relates to the taxation of individuals who are employees who work cross-border. And just in a little lesson in tax, the tax or the source of services rendered is where those services are rendered. So if a person works, who is not a resident, works in South Africa, for example, they would only be taxed on the income they earn here, not on the income they earn outside South Africa. Now, in South Africa, we have a worldwide taxation regime. So that means that if you live in South Africa and a resident, you get taxed on all your income worldwide, regardless of where you earn it. So what that means is that if you earn income from working outside South Africa, say in Zimbabwe, then what would happen is, without specific legislation, you would get taxed in Zimbabwe, subject to certain double tax treaties, but that's very limited, and you could get taxed in South Africa. At the moment, there's a law in place that says if you stay outside the country, as in outside South Africa, for more than 183 days, and 60 of those days are consecutive, then South Africa will not tax you. So if you're in Zimbabwe on a secondment, for example, for more than 6 months, then basically you will not be taxed in South Africa, you will be taxed only in Zimbabwe. The proposal that's come out of the review is that are to be removed. And we would like to suggest that be looked at very, very carefully for a number of reasons. We've spoken for some time today about investing in Africa, and obviously this looks at people who are working in Africa and other countries. The exemption that I've spoken about, the six-month exemption, is operational in 26 other OECD countries, so this isn't just a South African thing, it's a global point that people have in their, or which countries have in their legislation. The situation would be, if it is removed, is that person that goes to work in Zimbabwe pays tax here and pays tax in Zimbabwe. That will be deducted at source. So the person, if they're paying 40% tax here, 40% tax, for example, in Zimbabwe, will be left with 20% of their income, which is clearly unsustainable. What they're allowed to do is claim a credit against the South African tax of the Zimbabwean tax paid. But we all know, I'm sure you've all had a refund, that it will take at least a year and a half for you to get your money back. So my question is, what is that individual going to live on? So what are his choices? The choices are that he can leave the country completely, as in emigrate. If he does that, if he ceases to be a resident, he will suffer an exit tax. He will pay capital gains tax on the value of all his assets here, which is very penal. So if he leaves, he's going to have to go for good. In other countries, what happens is that a person may leave the country, cease to be a resident, and remain capital gains tax, in the net for capital gains tax, so that they don't have that capital gains tax hit. So that is an option, but not the best option, clearly, because we don't want these people to be leaving the country. If they leave the country, they take with them their skills, they take with them the learnings that they have from offshore, which they would bring back after their secondment. And they also don't bring back the funds that they've been earning. So that is really not a good solution. The other aspect that one needs to consider is, what about the companies that are employing them? Often, in order to attract these people to do this work, the companies will actually pay the tax on their behalf in order to make sure they don't pay double tax. But again, what's going to happen is it's going to make it a lot more expensive for these companies, and they're going to rather choose foreigners to do the work outside the country than choose South Africans. Clearly, that's not what we want. We want investment in other countries from South Africans in South Africans, not in foreigners. So we really do suggest that this be looked at very, very carefully before it be removed. The next aspect I just want to talk about is the proposal repensions, and I think it's a big positive move that we are going to have a situation where these pensions are looked at. The big question always is just, does one tax a pension where the pension fund is or where the person is? So is it the national origin of the pension, or the national source of services? Where does one tax that pension? And there's been a lot of confusion in South Africa for many years about how these things are taxed, because the laws, although there are some laws, they're not at all clear, particularly in certain circumstances. So we welcome that, and we would suggest that it may be beneficial to suggest that going forward, deductions, whether the person is a South African or a non-resident, deductions are made when the payments are made, and that the amounts come out are taxed, so that you've got an equal deduction and an equal inclusion. The one caution we would have is that where people are already retired or they're on their way to retirement and they have perhaps immigrated to South Africa, for example, and have offshore pensions which are currently tax-free, that we'd be very, very careful not to change that regime so that these people suddenly become taxable and their retirement planning is jeopardized. The next aspect I'd like to just chat about is a local aspect, but it does also broach the foreign scenario, and it relates to a situation where the South African Revenue Service believes there's avoidance taking place, and this relates to loans that are going largely between connected persons, particularly where there's interest charged and the interest is being received by an exempt entity. So one can see where the avoidance could sit. The proposal is that where the debt is what's considered to be excessive, then the interest deduction will be disallowed, but it will be able to roll over 4 years. And there's going to be a formula put in place to say that interest disallowance is the amount which exceeds 40% of the taxable income after other interest, in other words, interest to banks, etc. Now, I'm just talking about it and you're all glazing over. It's clearly going to be very complex. And the point that FICA would like to make is that when you have avoidance, there is avoidance legislation in place, and one should be careful not to always try and address it with specific avoidance legislation, because what a specific avoidance legislation does is capture normal, not avoidance types of transactions. So your vanilla normal debts that have not been raised because of avoidance may be attacked. That particular provision is meant to also possibly be replacing the specific legislation regarding acquisition debt as well. And that would actually be welcomed in some respects, because at the moment there's a requirement to actually get approval, and obviously that's quite long-winded. The final point I'd like to make, and it is also mentioned, is about the certainty that one has in investing in South Africa. And obviously tax law is amongst many other laws that one has to look at if one is investing in South Africa. But as an example of the lack of certainty that we provide our investors, the provisions for transfer pricing, and just to recap, transfer pricing is when you've got transactions between connected multinationals, cross-border, and what the transfer pricing legislation does is make sure that those transactions are at arm's length, so that each revenue authority gets the right amount of tax. So the legislation is absolutely 100% correct and right. But we had a change to our legislation a year ago, and in that change, what was removed was a provision or a reference to what they call thin capitalization. When companies invest in South Africa, they need to know how much money can we put in as equity, and how much money can we put in as debt, on which we can charge interest. Right now, there is no certainty on that. There is a practice note which related to the old legislation. We don't know, and we're advising clients, we don't know whether to tell our clients stick to the practice note, or the practice note will not be accepted by SARS. We've been asking for clarity on this for a year and a half, well, in fact, almost 2 years now, and we still don't have clarity. So what do taxpayers who are investing in this say, well, you know, why can't you tell us what we must do? And all they want is clarity. They're prepared to do whatever is necessary. So I think the point that needs to be made here is please emphasize to the Revenue Authority when legislation is put in place, put together with it the necessary interpretations so that there is certainty. And that brings us to the end of our presentation. I hope it wasn't too technical. I was getting into the detail of the legislation, but we've only selected a couple of issues. There are obviously many more in the legislation. So I'll hand over for questions.
No, it can't be too technical because it affects us. We understand it very well. Thank you. Honorable members, we have got some few minutes. Questions, comments? Honorable Mashile, Nyambos, Honorable Chawalala, Honorable Ross, Des Van Rooyen. List is closed. Mautunogala is not my problem.
Chairperson, I think I've just been taken aback, but to try and literally get this thing clear, I think last year, Chair, we did have a discussion on the tax consultants, and there was a clear indication that the body that actually looks after these tax consultants does not have total control on the industry. There are many that are not under them, and they are not actually doing any oversight over them. And I'm not sure that the response that I've just got now, as it seeks to say all the tax consultants in the country are there doing their business, actually trying to make life honestly. Unless if last year we have been misled, Chair. But the question that can be raised is whether SAICA has got total control of all tax consultants in the country. And if the answer is yes, and then what is the response to the comment that the Minister of Finance last year indicated that there are those that are even not paying their own taxes as organizations, let alone assisting honest companies not to pay what they should actually pay to government. I think that is the one question that needs to be answered. I'm not talking to an individual or an exceptional company. We're talking to an industry which is split, one controlled with so many elements that are not controlled and actually doing us down. That's what is being raised. And then from on the FFC, I think after the minister tabled the budget, then we have heard many economists and commentators saying, no, it's the budget lacks detail. What is that that we are actually talking about? What is that that these consultants or these economists or commentators are actually trying to say? Are they expecting a budget speech of the minister that takes 6 hours? Or a document, the budget document that fills the whole room? And what are other ministers supposed to be doing if they expect all details from the minister's budget speech? What is that that is, or what is your view, whether there is any way that we can actually resolve that kind of problem, where the Minister of Finance actually has to table a budget and put it in clear detail that even the relevant ministers don't even need to do anything? Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. My question is on your FSC, on your slide 13. Seemingly, you agree about the three rating agencies' statements here when you say it was based on politically factors, economical, social economical issues. But when you go to your slide 50, you can see that the growth, the real growth of the state, the debt is coming down. How do you balance the two? And if you can explain to us as well why the other agencies has disagreed with this with this rating as well. Thanks.
Thanks, Chairperson. The question is on the increase on dividends. Last year in the last year's budget was speaking about the increase on big companies around dividends. I think we're seeing around 5%. So I just want to find out from where you sit, because it will increase our revenue or from your clientele basis. How does that feel with you? How does it come? What's your feeling around it? Thanks.
Thank you, Chen. So just to remark with regards to debt sustainability and the sovereign debt downgrades and public debt, servicing our debt now is 100 billion per year. And thank you very much for your presentation. I thought to the Finance and Fiscal Commission, I thought it was very good. And here's just a clear indication that I think you've mentioned that we are about on 40% to GDP in terms of the debt ratio. But do we add the contingent liabilities of if we add it together, aren't we then on about 50% to GDP? Just your views on adding the contingent liabilities. And then in terms of the rating agencies, the downgrades and the possibility of a downgrade, I've just read in the newspaper that the possibility is set on the lower side. I think that means that people are quite happy with the budget, that there's no imminent risk at this point for further downgrades, and which is good news. But they do mention some of the pressure points, and I'd just like your views on some of the pressure points. Is it including perhaps, and I think somebody mentioned Casato. I don't know what the position of Casato is. Have they bought into the budget, and have they actually endorsed the National Development Plan? Because what we need to do now to avoid the further downgrading is to build confidence, and as you've mentioned in your presentation, with all stakeholders. And that is just something I'd like to have your views on. The corruption level is also important that we stop that. The local government, the 20 billion fraudulent waste of expenditure, and the more efficient public services, an effective public service, perhaps the establishment of procurement offices in terms of the supply chain management would be important to stop those issues. That would be my question to you in that regard. Quickly to Saika, thank you very much for the technical presentation. When we talk about debt, you can see that I'm speaking more difficult to eat now because your throat sort of seems to can't handle the shocks. I was very shocked to see that there's you know, in terms of the restriction of debt to prevent base erosion, I'm not quite sure what it means. In my days when I bought a couple of businesses, I always used to buy property incurring debt, which is an incentive for economic growth. You buy the business, you employ people, and there's a spin-off effect. Without debt, you can't finance it. It's just in my view, and I would like to know whether you share this, it's an instrument to promote economic growth. You incur debt, which you can afford, hopefully, and sometimes not, and you grow your economy, and this is the base from where you grow your economy, and then you have the spin-off effect in terms of economic growth. I hope you agree with me on that. And then all the other technical issues, I think we will have to sit down and go through it perhaps again. It's complex, and I think just an overarching comment is, Chair, I think it's stifling the economy. If we shouldn't stifle the economy, we should open up trade and investment, etc., especially on the investment side. I also see some impediments there. Thank you.
Thank you once more, Chair.
Chair, some of the submissions made in the two presentations were obviously talking to the envisaged tax review process. So, maybe avoiding running the risk of being accused of not processing some of the submissions properly. I hope the expectation is clear that some of these issues will be entertained at an appropriate time, you know. And I hope we are not going, when we call for, if it happens, if we call for submission, I think that's going to happen during the tax review process. We are not going to get accused of not processing it as presented today, because our specific focus today is on the details of the budget speech. I just wanted to clear that. I know from FFC also, there was a reference to the need to expand the review to include, among other things, borrowing policy, as well as the optimal debt level. So I just hope that the submission doesn't suggest that processing of such must be done immediately by the committee, as we'll be engaging in this. I just wanted to confirm that. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe just before you respond. Not so much on the tax issues, because tax proposals also follow the particular process as we move on. It's quite detailed and intensive. There's the professors in beard and all that to come in to tell us all important issues as we move on. But just on the FFC, Wongan, I hear you on the science and technology budget that you have noticed a positive growth of 12.8%. And you then say it is good because of the engineering capacities that we need for infrastructure, so on and so forth. But I would have thought in your analysis you would not necessarily look at the natural growth of science and technology in relation to the skills that you're talking about. Because science and technology should be key in research and development. Engineers and all those things, FET colleges will deal with them and all that. Because if we want to grow our economy and deal with the challenges that you see in the fiscal framework and the presentation of the speech, it's what kind of new technological innovations we need to take us forward. And therefore then takes you back and say, what is the extra percentage of research and development in the budget? Because all economies of our nature will spend a particular amount of money, a percentage of their GDP, to be dedicated just on research and development and key sectors of the economy. So I thought your assertion has missed the point in terms of the budget of science and technology. Amongst others, in terms of the research that we'll be looking at, I think one of the missing links in the growth trajectory of South Africa in terms of economy is the role of township and village economies. Because the way we look at townships and villages in particular, we look at them as residential areas, not economic activities, place. People must go there and come back to work somewhere. And there's a great deal of economic potential that we should be looking at in terms of our research. And this is what Brazil has actually done in terms of changing its own village products and then the township products, one village, one product, you know, into the market. And you formalize that. So your research must actually talk to those kind of things. And therefore, your research and development budget is quite critical, not just to say we need engineers. Science and technology doesn't do that. Now, the other thing that in terms of your analysis of the economic challenges, which is quite important for us, especially if it comes from the FFC, I have been watching the mutative nature of the economic problems, global economic problem. It is mutating. First, it was unsecured debt, insecure debt or unsecured debt in the US, no income, no job, no assets. When it came to Europe, it gets sophisticated, it becomes a sovereign debt problem. It went back to the US, it's a fiscal problem, fiscal debt problem. Now it's a sequestration problem. If you read the FT this weekend. Now, and I don't hear any all the presenters in terms of the fiscal framework and the global economic challenges to say what are the implications of this thing. All of them are saying if the conditions don't change, we'll then have this negative effect. But I think we should go beyond those things. And that will help us as the committee to say, moving forward in terms of our report and recommendations in terms of fiscal framework, this is what we've picked up. Don't give us general information that Soros has spoken about. All economists, you know, they all come if you read one book and you read the analysis today of National Treasury, you go to the Reserve Bank, we come to you, it's the same information. I can read one document, I don't have to read your document, because you say all the same things. But I thought you should delve much deeper in terms of your own analysis, especially at the FFC. That's just my comments. That doesn't mean we must not respond to the challenges that honorable members have raised. Thank you. Can we start with you?
Yes, sir, I'm happy to start. If I may just comment to the Honourable von Rooyen's comment. We tried in our comments to limit ourselves to proposals in the budget that we could gather from the document itself and from discussions with Treasury as far as the implementation to be imminent. And we thought that this would impact on our on revenue collection. So if they presumably must have in the mind, if let's just take the trust as an example, if we change the trust door now, we will get this additional income. And we're really sounding a caution, saying it's more complex than this. It cannot be amended as quickly as that, and you probably will find a lot of pushback from taxpayers when you amend that. So our comments are in that context, and we then certainly want to again reaffirm our availability to engage. And we are invited to the process when the draft bills are made available, and as a body we comment on that, and therefore I started the point with actually acknowledging that SARS listens to us, and when we make proposals actually take that into account when they amend the revenue law. So our focus was to say there are some things that we believe would impact on revenue collections, and we caution on that basis with the law there. I will start, I think if I can, with the questions then as it was raised in the order, dealing with tax consultants and tax practitioners. We would firstly like to point out that, yes, when we last presented the Act and wasn't signed the Amendment Act to the Taxation Laws, to the Tax Administration Act, was implemented a system where all tax practitioners will now have to be registered with SARS, and also with the recognized controlling body by the end of June. So from the 1st of July this year, all people that operate in the tax law, providing advice, submitting returns on behalf of their clients, will have to be registered. And certainly the engagement with SARS at this moment has been on that, and there are some 70 bodies that have indicated that they would want to be recognized by SARS. And one of the critical things in that is that there must be a code of ethics, that must be a disciplinary code. So really from body side, and I can only speak on behalf of SICA, we We believe that we've got about 7,000 members engaging in tax practice. And certainly going forward, we would take this seriously. We would ensure that our members are acting with due professional care and certainly not engaging in rogue tax avoidance schemes, etc. And we would also expect SARS and the ability is been made available in the tax legislation that they can report unprofessional conduct to us. And I think our understanding is that we will then follow that up and really report on that. And if we have people that are acting outside of common constraints, that we will take them. So I think your concern is addressed in the sense that the law is there now, the professional bodies are there, and we are certainly aware of our responsibilities as with regard to this. Deborah, do you want to add something?
Yeah, can I just add to that, that and you may or may not be aware, but there's been a move globally towards tax morality because of the economic situation in the world. If one looks at what's been happening, large corporations are now saying, not how much tax can I save, but what is the right amount of tax that I can pay, and I need to make my contribution. And I think it's been forced. I think the media has been a big contributor, as well as if one looks at, for example, the UK and the public and the way they reacted to the banks, etc., and they've been saying, why must we bail these people out? Companies now are, when we address companies, they're saying, we want to pay the right amount of tax. We want our effective tax rate to be a reasonably effective tax rate. So there's been a whole mind shift. And all commendation to the South African Revenue Service in South Africa, because their level of enforcing compliance is assisting in making sure that large companies in particular, and I deal with large companies, are taking that view. Just to move on to the next question about the dividends, I must say it's very new. And we're not really, companies are withholding the taxes when they're paying out to the individuals, or their intermediaries are withholding. And they're really just trying to get their heads around the mechanics. So I can't really say, there isn't anything in the budget review that says this is the amount that's been collected. And I can't really say, that it's a good or a bad thing that the rate was increased. I'm sure it's given rise to a higher tax. But, it's difficult to give any input at this stage because, I'd say most of our clients are simply battling with the mechanics of it, you know, which pieces of paper must be filled in and what must they collect and who must they withhold from.
Thank you.
Okay. I will share response to a few of the questions and also share them with my research director. But let me start with your questions because I think Part of the questions that you raised, especially the issue of the village township economies and people beginning to look at those, is actually work that is forthcoming from the Commission. We've been doing a big project in that area. So in our next forthcoming submission that will be tabled in May, we'll be speaking to some of those dynamics, because the metros and cities are hired as being referred to as engines of growth, because there are other growth pockets that you can look at. So we actually got something forthcoming there. In terms of the mutating nature of the global economic crisis, I think that's a very interesting issue that you raised, because in our AGM, we had a discussion with the Minister of Finance, actually came to the Commission, and that's one of the questions that he raised. What do we do? What is the story that we write about South Africa on this particular matter? Now, I think one has to look at this thing in terms of what South Africa's place in the global economy. We also have to look at how do we take shocks, global shocks, as an economy. So it does reflect in our trade balance, definitely. So we've got to be looking at what is happening there. So we've got to start. If we were to do a full story on that one, Honorable Chairperson, we can do it, but one thing that we will have to get into is how fiscal policy responses, which are what we are here talking about, interface with the monetary policy responses to those kinds of events that are happening there. But I think the story of the problem being diagnosed by rating agencies, by top investors, is this type of a problem when it gets to a specific environment. That's a story that is still evolving. I was just looking this morning at a report from Reuters about the lawsuit that the U.S. government is considering against Standard & Poor's. And if you look at the story, some of the facts that the Department of Justice there has put on the table, it actually tells you, almost like suggests some conspiracy stories around, it's still to be tested, obviously, in court, around how these ratings actually happen. So it's a story that must be written, and we do agree with you, and the Minister of Finance actually challenged us to actually think around that line. So we will basically try and look at how we can intervene in that. The issue that you raised also, when we look at the science and technology, we were just looking at what is given in budget. So we did not get into where we need to actually pick. And I think I agree with you that the R&D part and part of the work that we did last year for the submission that we had tabled for 2013 was beginning to build a story around that. And as we move to our 2014 submission, we carried some of that work. Unfortunately, we never got to brief this particular committee on that submission. But it's work that we have actually started doing in 2010, I think we started that. But that's something that's forthcoming. Then let me come back to Honorable Van Rooyen. You have picked on the issue around the tax review. We're not just looking at it, and I think the reason why we're saying that it should include is because we're looking at it as a revenue issue. So government revenue is not limited to tax. So if we have to make a specific submission when the actual review is being done, we're looking at it as something that's going to but we're just beginning to sensitize you to some of the issues that we think need to be taken into consideration. Certainly, if we have to make a submission directly on that particular issue, we will actually be able to do that, and I don't think that there's any issues there. The issue of debt, corruption, supply chain management issues, Honorable Ross, you raised quite a number of issues. And I must just say again that from the Commission side, this issue of credit downgrades and all of that, it's important. It's an important part of what we must do. We must be sensitive to what other people say. But we cannot actually be subjected to the whims. And because if we all accept in South Africa that what we are doing, and we have tested these things, we have demonstrated commitment to counter-cyclical fiscal policy, we have committed to consolidation. So all of those things, we have actually tested them. There is evidence that this is actually happening, and this is where this government is going. So when you then put that as part and parcel of considerations that you take, because certain sectors or certain pockets, you don't trust whether they will actually stick by that. But government policy is government policy. So if the NDP has been adopted by government as a point of departure, as a commission, we will actually assume that it's there. So that's the point that I just want to raise. On the corruption issue, the commission will be, I think it's in early April, we'll be signing a memorandum of understanding with the Public Service Commission on a project that we've been working on corruption and complementing what the work that they've actually been doing from a macroeconomic and what the impact of some of these aggregates that we're talking about here of corruption actually is. So there's work that is ongoing there. The detail, Honorable Mashile, our views on the detail, I think there would probably be that the budget as a statement of government policy on specific issues relating to the finances, we don't think that it will include every little program, what education must actually do, what this department must do, because those are specific programs with their own people that will actually deal with them. All we need to do, if we are fair, is to assess whether we can check what is said in the broad statement on financial policy or fiscal policy, that the budget, whether we can actually turn that into the plans of the department. And I think detail, obviously, it's a very subjective matter because it depends what you are actually looking for.
I thought on that one, Honorable Mashile responded to himself.
Okay.
So
he responded to himself.
Okay. He was basically saying, you can't satisfy everybody.
So I think that. So let me stop there, unless Ramos want to add. So I think it's comprehensive enough. Let's stop.
Thank you. The honourable members, the meeting is adjourned. Till further notice.
Thank you all the presenters, and thanks for always coming here to, and I think Honorable Conor Curran of captured it very well. Without you, there will be no public hearings. Tomorrow. Same time. Yeah, you'll see it.
Okay.